This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. This is the Morning Run on BFM 89.9. I'm Melissa Idris with Julian Ng and Sharad Kutan this morning. Coming up on the Breakfast Grill, we're going to be honing in on the issue of intellectual property. Now, that was one of the bigger issues in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. While the TPP has 12 signatory nations, all these countries are at a different level of sophistication when it comes to IP laws. And now the TPP is asking all signatory countries to ratify their IP laws to be the same across the board. The question we're asking this morning on the Breakfast Grill is, how will Malaysian IP laws change to meet the requirements of the TPP? We will be speaking to Abdul Aziz Ismail, Deputy Director General of Industrial Property for Intellectual Property Corporation of Malaysia, or MyIPO, as we know them better, as well as Sir Ka Liang, Director of Ella Cheong, which is an IP firm here. So it's going to be a robust discussion on the issue of copyright laws, patent laws, trademark laws, all the changes that could likely happen following the ratification of the TPP. That's on the Breakfast Grill coming up in about 20 minutes or so. But first, let's get back to the biggest business news of the day. The new governor of Bank Negara made his debut keynote speech yesterday, and he says that the Islamic finance sector must embrace the financial technology revolution, which will be the next game changer for the industry. So he's focusing on fintech. Jules.
Fintech is challenging the status quo of the financial industry. New business model will emerge. Delivery channel will challenge existing norms. Transaction costs will be reduced. Rather than looking at the fintech revolution as unwelcoming, financial institutions ought to embrace it as an opportunity. The potential impact of such technological disruption is significant. An estimated 10 to 40% of overall banking revenues could be at risk by 2025 due to fintech innovation outside the banking industry. They are able to achieve a significant pricing advantage.
And that was Dato' Mohamed Ibrahim, the new Bank Negara governor. I guess he's really saying that, hey, banks, if you don't buck up, you will be just decimated by all these new business models, financial, fintech business models coming up. And to me, that statement is so enormous. 10 to 40% of banking revenue at risk by 2025. Now, 2025 isn't a long time away, and 40% of banking revenue is huge. I mean, to quote Donald Trump, right, it's huge.
But you don't have the right hair to say that, Jules.
And the right voice and the right arrogance. But with 40%, I think if your earnings are hit by 40%, the banking stocks would crash, and along with it, the stock market. Unless you re-establish a new base with listed fintech companies.
Julian, do you think that's a good thing? I mean, banks had too much power? Have they paid themselves too well? Have they done, too well, you know, over the last decade, considering all the kind of financial scandals emanating from really bad banking practices, you know, and maybe, you know, this would be humbling and a positive game changer for the banking industry.
It's not only humbling. I guess it's a good thing to devolve a lot of the banking activities to some of these more independent businesses. I mean, we know too well the problem of too big to fail. For example, we have been talking about a lot about Bitcoins and their blockchain technology. Some articles have proposed that this will actually allow central banks to lend directly to customers. Central banks to take deposits and lend directly to customers. So, and the advantage of this is to eliminate the problem of banks lending out money that they don't have, right? So the central bank takes care of all the balances within its institution and then eliminate that too big to fail problem. The central banks have, of course, less efficient than commercial banks. So I'm just wondering if commercial banks of the future will be reduced to just support, vetting, and just taking care of these bank accounts.
Oh, wow.
Now, this statement by the Bank Negara governor, is it Is it only a national problem? Or are we looking at really a global financial?
It's a global problem. I mean, you're talking about peer-to-peer, challenger banks, etc.
So how do you solve a global problem at a national level? Or how do you negotiate at a national level?
I don't think it's a problem.
Yeah,
I think
sure
it's a great advantage
for
us.
It's a disruptor to the market, right? And the market is ripe for disrupting. For me, I'm curious to know if he was just referring to Islamic finance or if the entire financial industry is ripe for disrupting by fintech.
I think he's talking about fintech in general.
In general. Okay.
In general,
all right.
Yeah.
Well, he also mentioned yesterday, so that was, as I mentioned, his debut keynote address. And there was a press conference as well where, of course, he got questions regarding 1MDB. And in response to that, he said he's quite confident that the government will honour all its debt obligations.
Yeah, so IPIC sort of saved the skin of 1MDB yesterday by making good on the interest payment. So there isn't a technical default right now as like what happened in the first time. And the bonds, 1MDB bonds actually rose. I guess some investors would try to take advantage of the good interest rates that are being paid by 1MDB bonds. Anyway, it's going to be guaranteed by the government. So it's possibly a good investment at this point
in
time.
Well, you know, Franklin Templeton's Mark Mobius, he said that the negative news about 1MDB is short-term in nature, and he says it's unlikely to dent investor confidence in the Malaysian stock market. This coming from a very well-known investor.
That's right. I think the Malaysian government is very good at taking care of the interests of investors, not necessarily their citizens, right? Those two missions may not be in sync most of the time. Prime Minister Najib also said something very interesting. 1MDB encountered problems due to the failure to issue an IPO.
I
find
that
so interesting because I thought that 1MDB problems, 1MDB encountered problems because of 1MDB.
Did he think that an IPO would have solved a lot of the problems that 1MDB is facing? So his allegation is that because of all the negative news surrounding 1MDB, the IPO never made it because sentiment was so poor around the company.
And that is itself is a reflection on 1MDB as well, because investors would... This is a greed and fear thing, right? Because if investors don't think that this is a good investment, they would not subscribe. And why is it not a good investment? Okay. That's a 2.6 billion
so
ringgit question.
So he's blaming the lack of an IPO for 1MDB's cash flow.
Cash flow problems. But there's the timeline on this. The initial public offering on this IPO was when? And wasn't it, does it predate, in fact, the unraveling of the 1MDB? Nope.
I think it was part of the proposal to solve the debt problems. They were hoping to get a good price out of the IPO, but perhaps
it was... Energy,
that's right. And I guess it's also a case of bad luck, because at the time, the market was going through a very bad patch. So they had the Chinese coming to the rescue.
7:54 right now. Moving on to Malaysia Building Society, or MBSB, they reported that their net profit for the first quarter slumped by 72% to 35 million ringgit. And this is mainly due to higher allowances for impairment losses on loans, advances and financing.
So they had this long-term mission where they underprovided for their poor loans before. And now the loan coverage ratio mission is to have full coverage. They pushed it up to 94% in from about, let's say, 76% in 2014. That's why the earnings slumped sharply due to these provisions. It's not necessarily due to, I guess we don't know the full story. It's not necessarily due to bad performance. We don't know, however, whether loans that deteriorated badly in the quarter.
Okay, so MBSB, if I'm not mistaken, is not a typical banking institution, right? They're not regulated under a typical banking institution.
They're called a non-bank financial institution, and they're not required by Bank Negara to adhere to some of the more stringent measures that you apply to normal commercial banks. Surprisingly, guys, it's a fairly efficient company. Cost to income ratio stood at 22%. What do they pay their staff? Minimum wage?
Well, must be very efficient then.
No, but if you compare it to other Islamic banks, for example, Muamalat is 70% cost to income. Maybank Islamic 62. Is 62, CIMB 48. MBSB is in the 20s. And even the formidable public bank, the commercial bank, not the Islamic public bank, that's 33%, right?
Oh, wow.
So wages are only part of costs, right? Not an entire part of costs. Or a good part, is that what you're saying?
Well, you can argue that if you want to look for talent, like for a bank like CIMB, the cost-to-income ratio would be very high because they want to hire a lot of talent.
I think it's part that the salaries would be a huge component of the costs, for sure. 7:56 right now, let's take a quick look at Genting in Hong Kong. So Genting Hong Kong has put an order for 10 cruising vessels worth 3.5 billion euros as it seeks to expand its presence in the growing cruise business, particularly China. Now, I spoke to Princess Cruises on the Breakfast Grill not too long ago, and all cruise companies across the board have their eye on China. That is where the growth is coming from for the cruise market.
And Genting is all about leisure, gambling and partying. I think it's no surprise that they're diversifying, that they have taken this diversification route for a long time with Genting Malaysia, Genting Singapore and so on. Judging by the kind of sin taxes that were imposed of late in the tobacco and alcohol, and also the continuing Islamic dialogue in Malaysia, it's no surprise that they're diversifying away. Did you know that they own Zouk Singapore?
Genting?
Yeah, oh, Genting, no. Hong Kong.
No, did not know that. Did not know that.
They just bought into it recently, back in December 2015, for quite a lucrative amount of dollars.
I'm kind of curious to know about the shift. Now, if you think about cruise holidays, right, it's predominantly, I would think, you know, older, wealthier people. But now with the shift to emerging markets, to China and to this region of the world, cruisers are positioning themselves to be younger, hipper, funner holidays. And that is the holiday, that should be the holiday of choice for the young people. It's not just the fuddy-duddy old folks anymore.
Imagine, well, fuddy-duddy old folks have lots of money,
that's
by
true,
the way, and lots of time.
But with the new, the growing middle class in China, young folks have lots of money to spend as well.
And you could also establish a low-cost model and, you know, capture all these.
Oh, really? A low-cost model for a cruise?
That's why not? I mean, you've got
cruise.
Like, what?
Now everybody can cruise.
Zillion, no, yeah. Imagine putting Zouk on a boat. What would happen?
That's called
Try
party
about
cruise.
That.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see whether that's actually going to pick up or not. Okay, we've got The Breakfast Grill coming up after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. That is next on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.